cameras.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
You're ready.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because of cops, the next time you get in trouble, call it crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. The long, long list of corrupt Northwest governors has just added a brand new name, and the name is Tina Kotek. I want to get into the details of that, because I'll tell you something. They are trying to play themselves as the victims. And by they, I'm referring to Tina Kotek and her wife. She's in a lesbian relationship, Amy Kotek. They're trying to say, why, we're the victims. Amy is mentally ill. Amy is an alcoholic. Well, let me get into the details of that in just a moment. I think they're playing this for sympathy. I don't expect them to get any sympathy from any reasonable person. But let me explain why I'd say that in a moment. But first, welcome to the Lars Larson Show on a Wednesday. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to take your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. You can always vote in our X poll. You'll find the poll on X at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. It's brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. And our question today, you'll find this interesting because I'm going to state it as bluntly as I possibly can. If Northwest highways get too crowded, should tolls be used to push the poor people off the road? Because that's really what we're up against. We've, of course, talked about tolling in the Puget Sound region. We've talked about tolling in the Portland region. They've already got it in Puget Sound. In some cases, it can cost a single driver on one trip on the way to work or on the way home as much as $15 extra to drive in the fast lane on the freeway. Now, do I think that makes any sense? I do not. And even when they do it very, very efficiently, and in government almost nothing is done efficiently, about one-third of the money they take out of your pocket doesn't even end up going to the roads or the transportation department. It goes to the cost of collecting the dollars to begin with. And if you're inefficient, and we kind of expect that if Oregon decides to do tolling, and apparently they're hell-bent on doing it, even though it's been put on pause for a time by Tina Kotek, there's no indication that they have said, we are not going to do tolling. They've said, we're just not going to do tolling as we're headed up to the November election. They're simply putting it off until after you've gone to the polls, and then they're going to bring it right back. In fact, it's floating out there in the background all the time. Let me quote from a story by my friend Pat Doris at the NBC affiliate, KGW8. So he does a show called The Big Thing, The Big Story. Sorry, Pat. But what he points out is that they are going to use tolling, and the express purpose of the tolling, while they're saying all we're doing this for is because we have to have the money to build the roads, you know, because they know that goes over better than telling the public the truth. The truth is they want to force poor people off the road so the affluent and the elite and the people with bigger paychecks can be driving on the road. And you might say, well, Lars, you make a decent paycheck. Can you afford to pay the tolls? I absolutely can pay the tolls. Would it benefit you, Lars, if they pushed all the poor people off the road and you got to drive down a highway that was not congested? It absolutely would benefit me. And I'd barf. I hate the idea. I absolutely hate the idea that a government says to the public, you will pay for these roads, you will pay for these freeways, even though they're badly maintained, even though they're badly designed, even though we've intentionally crowded them so that we think we can force you onto a train or a bus. We've done all of that to you. We made you pay the bill. And now if you want to actually drive on one of those roads, you have to pay more. And I say that even though this scheme would personally benefit me. But like I said, I'd barf if that's what happened. So If Northwest highways are too crowded, should tolls be used to push the poor off the road? And let me quote from the big story. He quotes a guy named Finn at ODOT. One of the biggest economic drivers is what's happening in Washington County. You know, the elites. Intel, the semiconductor industry, Nike, Genentech, lots of huge employers that are great employers, meaning they pay big paychecks. Officials think the solution to the congestion problem, this is quoting a state official, will include tolling. But after Kotech told ODOT to pump the brakes on their prior plans, the agency is being much more careful about how and where they bring it up. In other words, they're constructively lying to you. They're saying, don't think we're talking about tolling. When you say, well, we've got congestion, how do you solve congestion? Bigger roads, more lanes. That's how you solve congestion. Or we could just push all the poor people off the road. The folks who are working minimum wage. The folks who are barely making enough to pay the bills. The folks whose checking accounts are almost empty at the end of every month. And then you say, how would you like to pay $5 or $10 to drive to work? And $5 or $10 for the privilege of driving on a road you paid for on the way home. How would you like to do that? Oh, you can't afford it? Well, then we're going to push you off the road so everybody with bigger paychecks can do it anyway. Now, let me get to the sad story of Tina Kotek. Now, I've confessed to you before, I grew up with an alcoholic dad. He was in my life for about 10 years as an alcoholic. And I know the kind of crazy decisions that boozers make. You don't ever want to be subjected to that. I'm not crying the blues over it. I got over it. But if you think about what's going on right now with Tina Kotek in the governor's office, she said, we're going to do great things in Oregon and we're going to be transparent. Only she starts that transparency by lying. Now, call me unsympathetic if you like, but I think the public has a right to know more when the governor of a state chooses a family member that she describes as mentally ill, that she describes as an alcoholic, to work in the governor's office. Is the governor making really good decisions for the people who elected her when she does something like that? Tina Kotek refuses to say what variety of mental illness afflicts her wife. And personally, I'd have plenty of sympathy for her in her family. I have no sympathy for her when she runs for an office and then says, I'm going to bring my mentally ill alcoholic wife to work. And by the way, a lot of the people she works with, who I assume are probably liberal progressives, don't like the idea either. Governor Kotek claims that Amy is in recovery, but she won't say how long she's been clean and sober. Now, most addicts I've met are proud if they've stayed dry for a long time. If you're not bragging about your sober time, short should be the educated guess. Now, Governor Kotek has taxpayers funding one of the governor's staff at $12,000 a month to investigate the idea of creating a job for the first spouse, Amy Kotek, inside the governor's office. She's already in the office. She's just not getting a paycheck yet. I'm sure that a state salary comes with that at some point. It also includes a staff member to keep Ms. Amy Kotek's schedule and a state police security detail. Tensions over the governor's addiction addition to her office have already caused three top staff members to quit: the chief of staff, the deputy chief, and one other. In the meantime, Amy Kotek represents the governor and you and me at public policy meetings on things like Measure 110 drug legalization that took more than 1,000 addict lives last year. What could possibly go wrong with that? Coming up, the Northwest Nonsense, your phone calls and your emails. You're listening to Honestly Provocative Talk on the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Words from President Reagan.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us. We the people are the driver. The government is the car, and we decide where it should go.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say. sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
So, a ship runs into a bridge, collapsing it and closing a major American port. And the first thing Joe Biden does is promise the federal government will pay to fix it. First of all, the company that owns the ship that did the damage should pay to fix it. That's the law, and that's the way it ought to be. With the 9,000-pound legal gorilla of the federal government going after that cash, I can imagine they can get it done if they want to. That assumes, of course, that the Biden regime isn't too busy cooking up new indictments of the president's political opponents to spend time on the actual needs of the American people. Second, Biden should keep Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg just as far away from this thing as he possibly can, even if Slow Joe or his handlers are only doing it to save votes. Since Buttigieg came on board as the affirmative action hire that checks the right progressive boxes, America has had nothing but transportation issues unaddressed by Pete Buttigieg. Crashing trains, toxic chemical plumes, an ongoing and still not resolved supply chain crisis, passenger planes with parts falling off in midair, massive flight cancellations because of computer problems, and a record number of airport near misses. That's all happened under Pete Buttigieg. You name it, Mayor Pete has failed at it, keeping him away from the Baltimore Harbor and let him go back to chest feeding his kid. Third, there are actions that Joe Biden or maybe Barack Obama calling the shots from his D.C. basement could actually take to fix this. Take all the crazy environmental rules that usually make projects like this take years straight to the recycling bin or whatever makes the Greens happy. Second, suspend prevailing wage rules that make union workers very happy, but boost the cost of every project to the stratosphere. Waive the local building regulations and get this thing done. My friend Steve Moore, the economist at the Committee to Unleash Prosperity, points to the example of a ship that took down a bridge across Tampa Bay in 1980. And the environmental impact statements alone took 2 years, and the bridge replacement took 5 years. When Minneapolis saw a major interstate, that was I-35, and a bridge there collapse because of, by the way, bad design and small gusset plates, a new, wider, modern bridge was in place in 11 months, finished ahead of schedule and under budget. That's the way to get it done, even if it means fewer union political contributions for Joe during this election year. Our question of the day comes in from Gerard Capron. He says, Lars, vote by mail is not the main issue. Vote by mail is just the delivery method. The real issue is voter rolls. Who gets a ballot in the mail? Dead people? People that no longer live here? Illegals? Oregon refuses to clean its voter rolls. That's how they cheat. What are your thoughts? I'm Gerard. Well, about a week ago, no, 2 weeks ago now, I gave my thoughts on this. There's a system called ERIC, which is run by a private, very liberal organization. It's not a company. It's not a government agency. And ERIC is the Election Records Information Center. And they are supposed to be in charge of cleaning the voter rolls. Only the outfit is run by liberal progressives and funded by billionaire liberal progressives. And the end result is they keep the dead people on. Without dead people, the Democrats wouldn't win any elections. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now.
Well, for the Daily Grill, I've suggested for a long time that liberals suffer from a kind of mental illness. But what should Oregon make of a failing governor, Tina Kotek, who sees three top staffers quit when she brings a mentally ill and alcoholic family member into work in her office? I'm going to give it to Tina Kotek. And in fact, it got me wondering this morning. John Kitzhaber had to resign after he performed a similar feat with his girlfriend at the time. She was making money on the outside, and there's no indication that Amy Kotek, Governor Tina Kotek's wife, is actually making money on the side. But when the governor does this kind of damage to her own office, she clearly is putting her personal life ahead of her obligation to the taxpayers who voted for her. I don't vote in Oregon, and I wouldn't have voted for Tina Kotek anyway. But if you're a Tina Kotek voter, what do you think about the fact that the governor is distracted by this kind of nonsense? Now, If you want to join what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. If you happen to be a naysayer, maybe you think that Tina Kotek is doing the right thing, seeing three of her top staffers quit, bringing in her mentally ill and alcoholic wife to work in the office, spending $12,000 a month to have somebody investigate the idea of setting up an official office of the first spouse. If you think that's a great idea, you want to be a naysayer, I would love to hear somebody who actually thinks that's a good idea outside of the Kotek family. Now, today's best email, and you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. This one I took the name off of, but a nice young lady wrote to me and said, I've never written into your talk show before, but I was listening yesterday, thought I'd share a real life example of a squatter situation I had listing a home in Portland. She's in the real estate business. A seller passed away without a will, and the house was vacant for some time while the court assigned a court-appointed trustee to sell the house. In that time frame, squatters moved into the home unbeknownst to the trustee. The trustee I work for called me to come meet him at the house once the court order was signed off on to list the property for sale. Upon arrival, we discovered that squatters had moved in. The trustee knocked on the door, and a woman living there told him that they'd been there several months and would not leave. The trustee had to go through the process to evict them as if they were tenants, and it took nearly 9 months. This is happening here in the Northwest. The house became a well-known crash pad for drug addicts, and upon eviction, there were hundreds of needles and drug paraphernalia left behind, which the seller had to clean up. They boarded up the house as much as possible, windows and other ways that people could potentially get in, and we proceeded to list the home. After the house was cleaned up for sale and listed, we had multiple break-ins from said drug addicts returning to the house as they thought it was potentially still a place where they could score drugs or crash or do drugs. Luckily, the neighbors were calling me and keeping me informed. Both of us reported the break-ins to the police. On the second call I made, I spoke with an officer who told me he'd go over and ask the squatters to leave if they were still there, but that they couldn't charge them with anything because it was considered merely trespassing and they don't book people on trespassing. I asked why. Wouldn't it be considered breaking and entering? He told me that because the house was vacant, it was only trespassing. This blew my mind. Over the weekend, another drug addict came by the house and the neighbors called the police. The police did come to the home at that point. On Monday, I got an email for a bill for $1,300 because the city had hired a third-party contractor to board up the house without the seller's permission. Portland is nuts. The whole situation leaves me baffled. I guess that's what happens when laws are not enforced and drugs are rampant. Name withheld from that one. I'll bet there are lots and lots of other stories like that. You know, Florida just made it legal for the police to remove squatters immediately. Yeah. How would you like to see that change in Oregon and Washington and Idaho? Glad to have you with me. 866-HEY-LARS. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Just listen for 5 minutes. You'll feel better. More with Lars Larson right now.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails in a moment. I've been looking forward to talking to our friend Nigel Jaquez. He is the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for Willamette Week, and find his stories at WWeek.com. And Nigel, I would remind you, is the man who broke the big story that ended up with the ouster, the resignation, and shame of Governor John Kitzhaber. And I'm kind of wondering, you wrote a piece today about this Tina Kotek, Amy Kotek situation, where the governor has brought a mentally ill and recovering alcoholic family member into the governor's office, and three of her top staffers have quit. Do the two compare, Nigel, between Tina Kotek and the now resigned and disgraced John Kitzhaber?
They compare in this way, that long before we figured out what was going on with Sylvia Hayes, a number of Governor Kitzhaber's top staff, including his chief of staff, resigned or left the office sooner than they would have been expected to, and we later found out it was because they were uncomfortable with Sylvia Hayes's role in the governor's office. They thought she was too involved in things that she was not, shouldn't have been involved in. And I think the parallel here is that last week, Governor Kotek's chief of staff and two other senior staff all left the same day. And so, yes, I think that is a parallel. It's my understanding, although they are not speaking for the record, that their departure was caused by their feeling that Governor Kotek's wife, Amy Kotek Wilson, was too involved in the governor's office. So that's the parallel. There's also a huge difference, as far as I can tell, and that's that Sylvia Hayes, while she was first lady, received many contracts worth many hundreds of thousands of dollars. She basically leveraged her position in the governor's office to get those contracts. As far as I know, there's no money. Amy Kotek Wilson, the current first lady, is not seeking to personally make money. So that's a big difference. But the underlying issue, the involvement in the state's business by the unelected first spouse, is a similarity.
I also looked up the official misconduct statute, and it says if an elected official does something to obtain a benefit for themselves or people they're associated with, I think that's the case here, and I'm interested in your take on that, because she doesn't get a paycheck, and I made that clear in all my commentary on this, that she's apparently not peddling influence the way the grifter Sylvia Hayes did, as you described. I called her a grifter, not you. But she does get a personal scheduler who will schedule all her travel, as Sylvia Hayes did. She does get a personal security detail, which the governor's wife might ordinarily get in any case when she's out doing state business. But now it appears Amy Kotek, the governor's wife, will have this security detail for some, I don't know if it's all the time or some of the time, but she gets a personal benefit in that way. Do you think that crosses the line drawn by the ORS that makes official misconduct illegal?
With a stipulation that I'm not a lawyer and there's a lot that we don't know, I don't think we're there.
Okay.
My understanding is that the governor's office has asked the state police to provide more frequent protection for the first lady when she is acting in an official capacity. And I think that has been the case with previous governors. If there's an event the first spouse attends in an official capacity, that the state police DPU, the protection unit, has been available. So I don't see that as a personal benefit, but there's a lot I don't know.
Okay, and there's a lot I don't know either. One of the other things, and I'll credit a writer I respect a lot, Pamela Fitzsimmons, who points out how soon before there, or how long till the three staffers who are forced out of Kotek's office by this situation will be, file a lawsuit, which will be settled. And she reminds me, and Kenji Harmon Johnson, who used to come on this show, she's the head of the Urban League, she doesn't any longer, but she said she got let go after a run-in with Sylvia Hayes. Harmon Johnson ended up with a six-figure settlement. Now, I'd have to go back and check that, but that sounds like another situation. Do you think perhaps the three top staffers who were effectively forced out by the presence of this mentally ill, recovering alcoholic wife of the governor are going to say, hey, I shouldn't have had to leave my job, but I did because the governor made this a hostile work environment?
Anything is possible. I don't know. We're all waiting. Willamette Week and OPB and the Oregonian have all filed records requests with the governor. We'll expect to see those records, and I think they'll shed a lot more light on the circumstances of those three departures. It's hard to say. You do accurately recall, yes, that Nkenge Harmon Johnson, who was Kitzhaber's communications director, she actually said on a conference call, we need to have Sylvia Hayes out of this office, not knowing that Sylvia Hayes was on the call. that resulted in her dismissal from the office, and she did win. She did fairly win, in my view, a six-figure settlement because of that. So I just don't know enough yet about the terms of, about the circumstances of these three departures. I expect to know more relatively soon. So hard to say.
I'm talking to Nigel Jaquez. Of course, there's a reason he won a Pulitzer Prize. I keep wanting to give you two, but you probably deserve two. But because of the work he did on the Kitzhaber case, which led to the governor's resignation, and now on this story, one other thing that I don't think has been getting a lot of attention, and that is, well, what has Amy Kotek been doing? Well, she's apparently representing the governor in discussions about how to deal with Measure 110, which I think I can literally describe as the deadliest public policy issue that is currently front and center for the entire state. More than 1,000 people died of fentanyl last year. The number 5 years ago was a fraction of that. And yet, here's this person who is both mentally ill by the governor's account, a recovering alcoholic, although we don't know if that recovery is a week or a month or a day, and she's a recovering alcoholic. I guess you could argue that maybe an addict who's mentally ill might have a better understanding of Measure 110. She wasn't elected by the people. Is it dangerous to have the governor's spouse, whether it's a lesbian spouse or a heterosexual spouse, representing the people, not elected by the people, not answerable to the people, on issues as important as Measure 110?
Well, I think that's the crux of the question, and I think that is why these staff members walked, is because, like them or not, respect them or not, the governor hires, every governor hires staff to advise that governor based on professional expertise, and, you know, those staff members are public employees. They're accountable to the governor. You'd like to think that we're hiring the best and the brightest to advise our governors. As you point out, Amy Kotek Wilson was not hired. She was not elected. She doesn't draw a state paycheck, so she is uniquely close to the governor. She's always been a very close advisor to Governor Kotek. However, she's completely unaccountable to anybody. So whether it's Measure 110 or any other issue, I think that's a problem when you have somebody who is not otherwise accountable to the people of Oregon or to the state chain of command who's involved in policy.
Is this bad enough it could lead to Kotek's resignation?
I don't see it. There's nothing that I know that I'm thinking to myself, gee, this is a bomb that goes off. I think it's a serious issue. I think Kotek is going to have to, at some point, answer questions that she hasn't yet answered. And I think it certainly gets in the way of her trying to execute the agenda that she's laid out. So
I think you're right. That's Nigel Jaquez. You can find his stories at WWeek.com. Back in a moment, I'll get to your phone calls and emails. 866-HEY-LARS. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
So you don't have to. Bringing the political heat. He's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@larslarson.com. I got to tell you about a couple of stories that really got to me. Number one, in Lakewood, Washington, there is a man who is fighting to keep his house. Now, I want to put this in the context of a country where we now understand that there are either hundreds or thousands, perhaps even tens of thousands of squatters who have taken other people's property. And yet in this case, this man bought his home legitimately more than 15 years ago. And when he first bought it in 2009, his name is Ibrahim Mirjalili. And I think I'm saying that right, Mirjalili. So he buys the house in 2009, but it was in such terrible condition, he couldn't move in immediately. So he sat there and he improved it and he renovated it and he did the work on it. His family finally moved into the house 12 years ago in 2012. So He said he's really proud of all the work he's put into that property. But now the city of Lakewood may force the man out. He and his family would have to leave their home of more than a dozen years behind because he got into a dispute with the city. He built a fence to safeguard his property because he's near to a park and he had numerous break-ins and thefts, so he put up a fence. He said, we tried to do something for our own security that the city was unwilling to do. Como News had the story. In 2013, we asked them to put in a street light here. They said, we don't have the budget for a single street light. So the fence led to a dispute on where the man's property ended and where the city's property began. Meanwhile, according to Como, the city says its plans for the property in 2019, City of Lakewood says we're going to upgrade Edgewater Park with a parking lot planned for the southern tip of the park right where this man's home is located. The city says the plan is still in the early stages, but they say that his property, get this, encroaches on three public rights of way and a section of the public property. Now, he said he's hired three different surveyors to clear up the issue. None of them found that the city had a right to his property. He says the maps that they have don't make sense. It's literally like somebody picked up the parcel lines from one area and moved it someplace else. So he's hired three surveyors. That ain't cheap. I know, I've done it myself. The dispute ended up in court in February, where a judge ruled that the city of Lakewood was within its rights to enact eminent domain to take the man's property for public use. Now, I've explained to people that the fact that the Constitution has eminent domain in it, I think, is necessary for the country. That's the bottom line. But I think government should only take somebody's property when there is an absolute need to do it. Because if you say, we need to build a bridge, and here in the Northwest, we have a lot of water. So if you want to build a bridge there and you want it to be roughly in one area, you know, to cross a river, to cross part of Puget Sound, I think of the Tacoma Narrows Bridge, or I think about bridges across the Columbia River or the Willamette River. There's usually one best place to put that bridge. If somebody owns the property and the only best way to build that bridge, which is necessary for transportation, is to build it from this point to that point, somebody owns the land. In that case, the government can use eminent domain, although I'd prefer the government went to the property owner and make a decent offer for the property. Do you know what the city has done? The city has said to this man, who has a house that is tax assessed at $1.3 million, we'll give you $250,000 for your house. You tell me what you'd say. The city comes in and says, we want your property. We'll take it under law if we have to. We'll offer you less than a quarter of its entire value. You and your family move out. Take this pittance that we're offering you, or we will force you out. I hope he fights them every step of the way. The city said they're going to go into mediation next month to talk about compensation. You know, when a city comes in and lowballs a man and his family and says, you put your heart and your sweat and your toil into building a property, into making the house so that it's just what your family wants. You're sitting there next to a park, which must be very nice. But the fact is, this man earned it. He bought the property fair and square. He had it surveyed fair and square. The city comes in and says, you don't own that. We own that, except we want some of your property as well, because we plan to put up a parking lot, like they say in the song. Now, I think this is wrong. And do you think this man, this Ibrahim Mira Jalili, is going to get any kind of just compensation when the city's first offer is less than one quarter of the property's value? I mean, the fact that the local county assesses it at $1.3 million and they're offering him $250,000, these are not honest people that you're dealing with. And by that, I mean the city is not being honest. Lakewood is trying to take this man's property away, pay him a fraction of its value so they can pave it and park cars on it. There is no justification. If you need to have a power line, if you need to have gas or water or sewer, and it may have to run through a piece of property because there's no other way to do it, then do that under eminent domain. But when you say, why, we need a parking lot for a park so that people can come and enjoy the park. If you want the property, offer the man enough to buy it from him, but to take him to court and to sue him. And especially when he's had three different surveyors who've all said, the city doesn't own that property, you own the property, and the city is breathing down your neck. That is not the kind of relationship that free citizens in the United States of America should expect from their government servants. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lord.
Ladies and gentlemen, you ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because of the cops, the next time you get in trouble, call it crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday, and always glad to get to your phone calls and emails. I want to talk about squatters. I mean, squatters is such a bizarre story in this sense, in the sense that apparently for decades, maybe even hundreds of years, a lot of America has had laws on squatters. It's just that it's only been recently when some of the people who have been squatting and some of the people who advocate for them have said, hey, you can take somebody else's property. And in fact, you could eventually, it takes a weird set of circumstances, end up owning the property that you're squatting in. What seems even more bizarre to me is that public elected officials who always like to appear to be bending over backward to try to help out their constituents don't seem to be doing much of anything to address this crazy situation. So I wanted to bring on our friend Jonathan Cho. He's a journalist at the Discovery Institute, and he's done some great work. And in fact, he's done some great work in dogging some of the politicians like Claudia Balducci about why they're not doing something about real problems of real property owners who are being effectively attacked and robbed. I would use the term robbed by people who are squatters. Jonathan, welcome back.
Hey, Lars, thanks for having me.
Would you mind telling the story of this man from Bellevue, Jaskaran Singh? I think I'm saying his name correct, although I might have murdered it just then. But
you said it. You said it fine.
Go ahead, sir.
Well, look, Lars, you can't make this stuff up. It's going on nearly 2 years now, but Bellevue landlord, mom-and-pop landlord, Jaskaran Singh, an Indian-American, who immigrated recently, just in the past year, I mean, becoming an official American citizen, that is, basically owned the property, and he's had a Korean national by the name of Sang Kim staying there without paying rent. He's owed tens of thousands of dollars now, and he refuses to leave, and there is a nonprofit here, an arm of the King County Bar Association, called the Housing Justice Project, that is now offering free legal aid paid by taxpayers to represent Kim. And they're essentially being accused now of buying Kim extra time and getting all these continuances because there is a backlog of evictions in King County courts. So it's a nightmare situation.
Well, and in fact, Jonathan, I don't know if you run into this yet, but there's a weird phenomenon that I just became aware of, and that is, if you try to evict somebody who's a squatter, somebody who was never a tenant, never paid rent, never had an agreement, but the minute you try to evict them, they say that that legal action effectively identifies them as and confirms that they are in fact a tenant, and then they get even better rights than they had as a simple squatter. I don't know if that matches up with what you've found, but it really leaves people in a situation where they have almost nobody to turn to. They go to the courts and they say, well, evict the man. Okay, I'm filing eviction. Well, you just granted him tenant rights. Now that's going to stretch it out even more.
Yeah, look, Lars, there's so many loopholes and just reporting on the story now since last November when I first kind of brought this situation to light. I've learned so much as well. But what I'm really learning is, again, that right now the state lawmakers here in Washington, the Democrats, in the name of protecting renters from bad landlords, and there are definitely situations like that, they've essentially overcorrected, and now the mom-and-pop landlords are suffering. And in many cases, they're saying to me, hey, I can no longer run this type of business here in Washington State I'm leaving after I sell my property. So this is further exacerbating the problem of affordable housing now as well.
Well, and let me ask you about this. Florida has actually, we've just seen a law signed, I believe it was today, by Ron DeSantis. The legislature fairly quickly passed a law that said, number one, there are fines for squatting. We're going to up the penalties. And number two, we're going to give the police the ability to immediately remove somebody that a landlord says, I never rented to this person. I had no rental agreement. They simply started living in the house. They had no permission. The police can immediately remove them. Do you see any similar movement in the state legislature to take action? If one of the 50 states can solve it and solve it that relatively quickly, why aren't the rest moving the same direction?
Yeah, this is, to me, common sense legislation that should be in effect in, you know, all 50 states. But at least here in Washington, again, this is really getting so political. My source is telling me behind the scenes that you have Democrats, you know, telling other local Democratic council members in places like Bellevue to not stand with Jaskaran Singh when he plans on protesting again this weekend to publicly shame serial squatter Sang Kim to hopefully leave the property. So, I mean, this is really becoming a political game. The Democrats, again, here in Washington, they enabled and passed these laws. And now that they're being called out, they're, you know, circling the wagons and they don't want to take responsibility.
Well, and the other problem to this is that, Jonathan, and I kind of anticipate this is going to happen. When you tell somebody, and a lot of the landlords in America are mom and pop landlords, they're a husband and wife or a couple of partners, they've bought a few properties over the years, they've fixed them up, they rent them out to people, they supply an absolutely necessity to Americans, and then they're told, and somebody can walk right in and steal it, and the law will be on their side. You're setting up a situation where I'm anticipating at some point people are going to come to blows. And I think, and I'm not suggesting that's the way to solve it, but when you give people no alternative, yes, this man or person can steal your property. Yes, the law is on his side. No, the law is not on your side. I think desperate men do desperate things.
Yeah, we've seen some incidents where, you know, it's been close to vigilante justice. I mean, this is what happens when laws are not enforced, right? And look, as far as I'm concerned, this is a bipartisan, it shouldn't be a controversial issue at all. And lawmakers on both sides of the aisle should be getting together behind this. But right now, that's not even happening. So again, Jaskaran Singh here in Bellevue is finally calling out both sides. He's saying this is not just a Democrat issue. This is not just a Republican issue. Guys, get it together and come up with a solution.
And actually, I think this is dire enough, Jonathan. It would justify a special session of the legislature to say, we've got to solve this. Florida's done it. We can use that as a blueprint. And if other states have done a better job, fine. Use their legislation. But when you say, well, fentanyl is a crisis, it is. Homelessness is a crisis. It is, and hundreds of millions of dollars are spent to solve that problem. But you landlords that supply housing to people, yeah, screw you. You're going to lose your property, and we're going to help people take it from you. That justifies a special session, if anything does.
I agree 100%. We'll have to wait and see if that happens here in Washington.
Yeah, well, I'm waiting for the first Republican group to come forward and say, we have to solve this problem. There's a way to do it. It has to be acted on now. You cannot put this off for 6 months or a year. It's simply not going to work. That's Jonathan Cho. He's a journalist with the Discovery Institute in Seattle. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday. Always glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. You can cast a vote in our poll on X. You'll find that at Lars Larson Show. And I got to tell you something. This is an ugly situation. I have been a landlord before of one tiny duplex. I don't own one now, so I don't have a dog in the fight. The fact is, this is going to get ugly. And I think that people are going to get hurt or killed. And it's likely to happen sometime soon in America. It's not the right way to solve it. But when the elected elite say they won't, that's where it's going to go.
.org.
He has small town politics with big town opinions. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'll be glad to get to your phone calls and emails in just a short moment. In fact, in a bit, I hope I get a chance to tell you about a very strange thing that the Biden administration has been doing with regard to competition in America. And Joe is absolutely undercutting the interests of American citizens by forbidding companies from merging, which, if you know something about the situation, you'd understand why those mergers would end up being good news for consumers and not bad news for consumers. But I can't let another minute go by without mentioning this. Tomorrow, President Trump is going to be in New York City, and he's there for a specific purpose. Joe Biden will also be in New York City tomorrow, except his purpose is entirely different and entirely selfish, as far as I'm concerned. Consider the idea that Joe Biden said he'd get to Baltimore after that bridge collapse and six people dying. He'd get there as soon as he possibly could. Now, I looked up on the maps. From Washington, D.C. to Baltimore to the site of the bridge is 42 miles. And the president of the United States has every resource available to him. The Beast, the big limousine. He's got Marine One, the helicopter. He's got all the resources he needs. And he says, I'll get to that collapse, a place where a bridge collapsed. And there are lots and lots of fingers being pointed as to who's to blame. The harbor master, the failure to put tugs out to control this boat. There are lots and lots of things that we might know, and we probably will know in days or weeks or months about why that accident happened, why that bridge was brought down, and Joe Biden's promise not to make sure that the company who did the damage pays the bill, but that the federal government will pay the bill. But what's happening in New York tomorrow? Joe Biden's going to be there because he's got a high-dollar fundraiser to attend with Barack Hussein Obama, the guy who's probably already calling the shots at the White House, and Hillary Clinton. So in other words, he's there to raise money for Democrats and his own campaign. Meanwhile, President Donald Trump is going to be in New York City as well. They're both going to be there. And this, in a lot of ways, this reminds me of the border visits. President Trump goes to where the problem is on the border. Joe Biden stays as far away from it as he possibly can, but still be in the state of Texas. In New York City tomorrow, Joe Biden will be there to raise money for politics. Donald Trump will go to New York City to attend the wake of a slain New York Police Department officer. Now you tell me, does that not just sum up the difference between those two men in a heartbeat? Your calls are welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. We've also been talking about squatters because out of all the 50 states, there is one state right now that has largely solved the squatter problem with one piece of legislation. It makes squatting illegal. It increases the penalties. But most importantly, it says if the owner of a property, whether it's a homeowner or a landlord, can identify somebody is squatting in that house, they're doing it illegally, the police will be allowed to remove the squatters immediately. Where in the other 49 states, we're hearing horror stories of people who own properties. Sometimes they inherit them. Sometimes they're the properties owned by family members, an aging mother or father. And a squatter moves in, and the police show up and say, nothing we can do about it. This is a civil matter. Why don't you go to court? They'll have the problem solved in a year to 2 years. Now, I don't think that's adequate at all. And I think that smart places will actually fix that problem. The lawmakers in Tallahassee, Florida, passed a law quickly, said, let's take action on this. The rest of the country is still waiting. On that note, let's go to Rob. Hey, Rob, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hey, thank you, Lars. Thank you for having me. When I heard you speaking to this issue, I had to call. I'm just a family guy trying to make a few bucks. I'm 64 years old. I went in on a couple apartment buildings with my son. We bought them last December.
Good
with
for
the
you.
Intent of fixing them up and getting them ready. If I'd known then what I know now, I would have never bought them. We inherited a squatter who's just, the situation is unbelievable. He's been there for 3 years. He's paid absolutely no rent. He's belligerent. He's threatening. He sells drugs from his door and in my parking lot. I've had the police out so many times, I can't even tell you. They don't want to hear from me anymore because they feel their hands are tied. And the purpose for my call, I don't want to disparage you know, any particular police department. The public service people are very frustrated. They're as frustrated as I am. It's
no
a
doubt.
Systemic problem, as you have pointed out.
Well, and it's a problem, Rob, that comes about because of laws. And when somebody figures out a loophole in a law and says, I can use this loophole to act illegally, because at the end of the day, when somebody who has no right to a property, they weren't a tenant, they don't have any ownership, they didn't rent it, they don't have a lease, and they say, but there's a loophole in the law I can use to at least live there for a time. And literally, if they live there long enough, although in most states, adverse possession takes 7 to 10 years, but if I live there long enough, I end up owning the property. Now, I can't imagine describing that to anybody and saying, yeah, that ought to be the law. I mean, there are lots of laws we might agree with. Say, you shouldn't go 100 miles an hour on the freeway. Okay, I can agree with that. You shouldn't dump raw sewage out of your toilets and your sink into the public street in front of your house, like maybe was the case 150 years ago. You can't just take your garbage out and throw it in the street. Okay, we got laws against all that. Now we got a law that says a squatter can come along and take somebody's property and even potentially own it someday by simply staying there. That, whoever thought that was a great idea?
Well, Lars, when I entered, I put a 48-hour right to maintenance. You can do that. I know the RCW is pretty well. I used to have a few rentals, but I'd been out of it for a while. My son-in-law wanted me to come in on this deal, and I did. But I just had no idea that the entire system has been on its ear. I think Washington at this point is probably one of the worst states. And I thought, we'll just engage an attorney. Well, I called around. Attorneys generally don't want to talk to you about eviction because they know how hard it is. They know how difficult. Or if they do want to talk to you, you're looking at a lot of money. We've engaged about three different attorneys. It's been there for 3 years now, not paying anything. But what I saw when I entered the unit to do a maintenance issue absolutely blew my mind. There were open needles, heroin, there were all sorts of feces, human feces, dog feces. It was unlike anything I'd ever seen, and there were two young children there. So I placed a call to CPS. I placed a call to the police. I said, you got to see this to believe it. I took photos. And then when they got the photos, they arranged for, they couldn't enter when I entered. I was entering on a maintenance issue, which I couldn't even get to the leaking water heater because the trash was literally 6 feet high. I can send your station photos. You wouldn't believe it.
I'd love to see them. But you would think if the system wanted to solve the problem, they'd say, we'll enter then on a life safety issue for those children. That would be a justified reason to enter. And I would think
they could use that.
They did do that?
So I arranged it with the CPS lady. I said, look, this guy's a turtle. He won't answer the door. He won't talk to me. He's a squatter. He just sells drugs, and we watch the drug deals, and there's nothing I can do. He has a camera at his door, so he knows who's coming, and he records everything. So I arranged it. There was a police raid last Wednesday or Thursday. I have the police report. If you care to, I can send that to you.
Send me all of that, because this is the kind of horror story I'm talking about. And this is why lawmakers need to act. Cities need to act, states need to act, and the state of Florida has already done it. So if anybody says there's no way to solve this problem, there is a way. There is a law. It was signed into law this week. The police can use it immediately. And if your lawmakers say, we're not going to do it, they're not doing their jobs. You got the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. Unwrapping the news so you don't have to. Back to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'll get back to your phone calls and emails in just a moment. Full disclosure, I own guns. I support the Second Amendment. And I think there's a great danger in what Vice President Kamala Harris, not ordinarily smarter than a bag of hammers, and this doesn't change that at all, she's come out and said, we're going to have a special National Extreme Risk Protection Order Resource Center, long title for something. And what is it going to do? Well, it's going to support the effective implementation of state red flag laws and keep guns out of the hands of people who pose a danger to themselves or others. That's the promise. Now, I've told you I don't like red flag laws. I don't think they work. In fact, there's a very good potential for them to actually work in reverse and actually cause more problems, and I've explained why. But I wanted to talk to our friend, Dr. John Lott, who's president of the Crime Prevention Research Center and the author of many great books, including More Guns, Less Crime. He is by trade an economist, and he looks at the numbers. Dr. Lott, welcome back.
Oh, it's great to talk to you again, Lars. Thanks for having me on.
So tell me this. What should we make of the fact that the this is coming down from Kamala Harris and Joe Biden, presumably, and they're saying, oh, we'll have this national center that's going to gather data and help states implement and I guess enforce their red flag laws to go out and take guns away from people before they've committed a crime?
Look, everybody is concerned about dangerous people having weapons. I mean, I don't think there's any disagreement about that. The problem is multiple fold. One is, the Biden administration just can't create a center on its own. It has to have Congress actually pass legislation allowing it to be created. But I think the more important problem, in a sense, is that we already have much better laws on the books that can be used. And these are these civil commitment laws that we have in all 50 states and the federal government. And what they do is if you're concerned that somebody may be a danger to themselves or others, you call the police. The police come out. The police think that there's a reasonable chance, which is like a 20% chance, that the person is, in fact, a danger to themselves or others. They can take them in for a mental health care evaluation. If the mental health care professionals agree that there is a potential problem there, if they think there's a reasonable chance, there can be an immediate hearing. If you can't afford a lawyer, one will be provided for you. And evidence will be presented there, and then a judge will make a decision. And then the judge has a range of options. He can let you voluntarily go to outpatient treatment and reevaluate the case in a week or two. Or he can take away your driver's license if he thinks you may drive a car into a crowd of people. Or he can take away your guns. Or, in the most extreme, they can involuntarily commit you. What red flag laws do is they short-circuit a lot of those protections based solely on a written complaint. The judge, without talking to the person who made the complaint, without talking to the person who the complaint is being made about against, the judge can take away your weapons. And that's the only thing that they can do, is take away the person's weapons. And then within a month, there can be a hearing, but no lawyer is provided for you. You have to go and get a lawyer on your own there. And that, you know, can run you $10,000 or more. And so you may want to have your guns, but most people are going to say, look, I want to have my guns, but is it worth $10,000 to me to be able to go and hire a lawyer when the worst thing that can happen to me is they take away my guns? And what you find is that most people don't hire a lawyer to go and help them out in those cases. And it's been abused. You and I know someone who's had to face these types of difficulties, for example. I know other people.
Yep.
One guy I know who's a good friend, Andy Pollack, who lost his daughter in the Parkland school shooting. He had moved to Oregon to get away from, kind of the memories of his daughter in Florida there. Moved to rural Oregon. Same time he moved in, he had neighbors move in next door to him from California who apparently really dislike him politically, and they filed an extreme risk protection order against him, one of these red flag laws, and had his guns taken away. And when they finally had a hearing on it, the judge didn't even need Andy to put up his side of the case. He didn't even put up a defense because the judge says, there's no threat here. Why did you file this complaint here? But the problem was, I mean, multiple problems. One of the problems was that while Andy has been disarmed, he had a mountain lion that show up outside his house. And he had his dog there, and the dog got into a tangle with the mountain lion. But the dog had to have like 50 stitches on its side from that tangle. Andy would normally, because the bears and mountain lions around there, would have normally had his handgun with him. But he didn't because of the extreme risk protection order. And that's just one example there that, you know, if they had had a hearing to begin with, the gun never would have been taken away from Andy.
But you get no due process. You lose your civil rights without due process, which is unconstitutional, and it can be used, as you pointed out, to harass people that you don't like politically. And so do I expect that the Biden administration wants that to happen? Yes, they do. I mean, they've harassed citizens through the DOJ. They've harassed citizens right. through the FBI. There are lots of examples, and they've made threats against Americans saying, if you're a Christian, if you go to church, if you're a conservative, if you believe in Make America Great Again, you are a potential domestic terrorist. Do I expect that an administration that would do that kind of thing is going to threaten the rights of citizens? Yeah. And really what we're talking about here, John, comes out of the movies and science fiction. It's future crime. You say that guy is right. so crazy, he's going to hurt somebody someday. Let's go out and let's do things to him that violate his civil rights to prevent him from committing a future crime. That's nuts.
Right. And they don't involve mental health care professionals involved. You know, if you really think somebody is suicidal, and that's most of these cases that are there, is simply taking away a person's guns a serious solution? Yeah, we've had places around the world, including Chicago and Washington, D.C., that banned handguns, for example. Is there evidence that handgun suicides fell? Yeah, there is. But what happened to total suicides? Total suicides didn't change. People simply switched to other ways to go and commit suicide. There are lots of ways for people to go and commit suicide. So if you're really legitimately concerned about somebody being suicidal, why do you think, gun control advocates want you to think, if you just take away the guns, all the problems are solved. And it's not. You know, it seems to me the thing that you should care about is what happens to total suicides, if that's really what's driving you. Just say, I just care about how they commit suicide. You know, if they commit suicide with handguns, that's bad. But if they commit suicide with some other way, you know, that's great.
Yeah, and John, I've always pointed out to people, I'm not an economist like you are, but South Korea, which is culturally similar to the United States, it has one of the highest suicide rates in the world, and they have virtually zero private ownership of guns. You don't own a gun unless you're in the military or a police officer. You say, well, they took away all the guns from their entire population. That must have solved the problem. And the fact is, it didn't solve the problem. South Korea still has one of the highest, and they didn't take them away recently. They haven't had private ownership of guns for the most part at all, even though they sit in a fairly dangerous place south of the little crazy man in North Korea. That's John Lott. He's the president of the Crime Prevention Research Center. I serve on its board of directors uncompensated. John's the author, most recently, of More Guns, Less Crime. Glad to get your phone calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
You can literally have Lars with you all day, every day. Podcasts at Spotify, Apple, SoundCloud, and live right now. What a time to be alive. Here's Lars.
Welcome back to the program. It's a Wednesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, which has for about a quarter of a century served the Pacific Northwest states, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. This segment of the show is brought to you by 540training.com. Concealed carry, home invasion defense, and personal defense online at 540training.com. Our poll on X today, what used to be the Twitter poll, if Northwest highways are too crowded, should tolls be used to push poor people off the road? That's the intent of people at WashDOT and ODOT. They want to push poor people off the road and allow the freeways only to be used unfettered by the elites. by people with good-sized paychecks. The poll on X can be found at Lars Larson Show, and it's brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Now, on that note, I get a naysayer today. Corey, welcome to the program. What do you and I disagree about today that makes you a naysayer?
Well, I don't necessarily know if it's you, Lars, or your guest, but saying that people commit suicide, whether there's guns or whether there isn't guns, is a ridiculous statement to me. Number one, I feel like your guest has never had someone with mental health in their family before to know that they don't want a gun. But he is right. People will kill themselves with ropes and knives and cars and jump off bridges. But the difference between all those ways and a gun is that a gun is manufactured to do one thing and one thing only, and that's to kill. And you do not want a person with mental health to have a gun in his hand that he could kill himself or he could kill others. And it's ridiculous to put it in the same category.
It's funny that you say that, Corey. It's funny you say that because, you know, the vast majority of my guns have never been used to kill anything except paper targets. Now, I have a few guns that have killed a lot. I mean, they've killed a lot of deer and a lot of elk. Occasionally a coyote, because the farmers and ranchers like it if you kill the coyotes. When you say it's only made to kill, I don't think so. It'd be like saying a steak knife can only be used to cut steak. Where did you get the idea that a gun cannot be used for target practice, cannot be used to suggest to somebody that is in your house and threatening you that they should leave without ever pulling the trigger, that gun has that capability and it's made for that as well?
You can justify what you want emotionally, but we all know them.
No. Give me a sensible argument against that. When you say a gun is only, if I said knives are only made to kill, would I be accurate?
No, you wouldn't. But, you know, you can do target practice with knives, too. I mean, you
yes,
can do
I can. Except that knives are not mentioned in the guns are the only consumer product mentioned in the U.S. Constitution, and they're mentioned very explicitly that every one of us as a citizen has a God-given right to keep and bear firearms.
I agree with that. And I'm a gun rights fan, but I believe, and again, if you've had someone with mental health in your family, you would know that
you don't have to have a crazy person in your family like Tina Kotek does to know that, yes, if you have somebody mentally in your family, don't give them a gun. But answer this for me. South Korea has a dramatically higher level of suicide than America. South Korea is at least it's similar culturally to the United States. Maybe different food, they speak a different language, but culturally they're very similar. It's not like comparing the United States and Kenya or the United States and Sudan. So why is it South Korea has a dramatically higher level of suicide in a country with no private ownership of guns?
Guns don't cause the suicide. And if you added guns to
Well, you're suggesting they do.
No,
aren't you suggesting they do?
No, I'm not suggesting that guns cause suicide. I said that guns are used in suicides, and if you gave South Korea guns, their suicide rate would go up because it's easier to kill themselves.
Then why is it in Washington, D.C., when they said you effectively can't buy a gun, that the total number of gun suicides went down, but the number of total suicides didn't go down at all? As John said, you're working from feelings, and you admitted that at the beginning. You feel this way. John's working from numbers. Which one should I believe?
Well, I can get number two.
No, answer my question. You work from feelings. John works from numbers. Should I believe feelings or numbers?
Well, I can give you some numbers. Mental health in universities. That I work in a local junior college, and our mental
health. That explains a lot.
Health is up. No, it doesn't. I'm actually a Republican, and I work in a junior college.
But you're swimming in a soup of liberalism, Corey. I've got news for you.
My stance on this has nothing to do with where I work. It has to do with my belief that a gun is manufactured to kill animals and to kill humans, and that's what it's for. Now,
or to kill paper targets.
Well, I like shooting targets. I love shooting some targets. I'm actually pretty good at clay pigeon shooting, and I'd love to do it with you someday because I think you're pretty good. But what I'm telling you is if someone is sick mentally, they should not have...
Then hold on, Corey, are there people at your work where you go, that guy's crazy? Have you ever said that about a coworker?
I mean, yeah, I suppose.
Okay, now hold on. Bear with me, Corey. We're going to get there. Bear with me. We've all said, that guy's nuts, or that gal is nuts Would you have the police come in before that person has done anything wrong and disarm them?
No, but if they have documented mental health...
No, hold on, hold on. Corey, at the beginning of this process, red flag laws do not work by talking to the person that you're about to slam the red flag on. All they work by is somebody says, that Corey, he's nuts. And you should go take his guns away. And they come and take your guns away. And then at some point, weeks or months later, you get a court hearing and you get a chance to hear, why did they take my guns away? But in the meantime, you don't get any due process. It throws the Constitution right out the window. But Corey, you're a great naysayer. Thanks for the call. You got the Lars Larson Show.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the bid show?
In
exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because they're cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get to your phone calls and emails. I want to talk about what's going on in the Middle East right now, because where ordinarily you might expect that the United States, the leader of the free world, would be taking a bold position, whether it was right or wrong, and as we're reminded by Bob Gates from way back when, that Joe Biden has never made the correct call on foreign policy ever in his career, and that was the assessment of a guy who worked for Barack Obama. So he wasn't, you know, he was favorably disposed toward people on the Democrat side of the aisle, but he thought that Joe Biden, when it comes to any kind of decision involving foreign policy, is usually not on the correct side of anything. And there's so many examples, I can't list them all now. So instead, I'll invite our friend Ari Hoffman on, host of the Ari Hoffman Show. He's on our Seattle affiliate, KVI, and he joins me now. Ari, welcome back.
Always a pleasure, but you just reminded me of that line by Barack Hussein Obama where he said, never underestimate the ability for Joe Biden to blank things up.
Yeah, we can't say that word because of the FCC, but it is the F word. It's just not the FCC word. So, yeah, I think Joe Biden is showing that. And in this case, what I really don't understand is this is one of those binary decisions. You're either in favor of saying to Israel, you were attacked October 7th, more than 1,000 slaughtered. Many of the people who were taken alive as captives were sexually tortured, according to, well, a source I would guess the liberals would believe, which would be the United Nations, and says that the hostages still being held all these months later, some of them are being sexually tortured, including babies and infants and kids, as well as adults are being sexually tortured. You either should tell Israel, don't wipe out the Hamas terrorists, or do wipe out the Hamas terrorists. And almost all the other countries have taken a position one way or the other. And here's Joe Biden, leader of the free world, and he comes up with, I'm going to sit on the fence.
Yeah, and it happened to be the day that the New York Times, of all outlets, actually published an interview with a woman who was one of the hostages who got returned during the last swap, where she was talking about the sexual abuse she suffered at the hands of Hamas. And then you have Jamal Bowman, one of the squad members, this video of him speaking to a whole bunch of his supporters in Westchester County, talking about how the rapes never happened, the sexual assault never happens. Joe Biden cares about a two-state solution, but his two states are Michigan and Minnesota. Those are the two states he cares about. What he's trying to do is he's trying to placate the radical left, who he thinks isn't going to vote for him. But realistically, who do you think the radical left is going to vote for in an election? Joe Biden or Donald Trump? Let's be real. They're not going anywhere, but he's trying to placate them because he's losing their support. So what happens is the other day, the United Nations has a ceasefire resolution.
Yep.
The problem with the ceasefire resolution is it doesn't call for the hostages to be returned as part of the ceasefire. It doesn't call for Hamas to surrender as part of the ceasefire. So we've sent in how much aid, and we're getting nothing in return for it. And in the end, it looks like Joe Biden's about to get us into World War III, because now the United States is demanding that for Joe Biden's little port that he's building in Gaza, that Israel provide protection for it. So let me make sure I got this right. You want American service members with bullseyes painted on their butt in Gaza being under the protection of the Israeli army who's currently being targeted by Hamas terrorists. Is he literally trying to get us into World War III?
It sounds like it, because I brought up that possibility the day he announced this pier, or whatever they're calling a temporary pier. And I said, there's no reason for it. I mean, it'd be one thing. There are certainly places in the world where the only way you can get anything in there practically is by water or by air. But in this case, you've got a place where all kinds of supplies could flow in tomorrow if the terrorists would simply stop doing what they're doing, and if Israel was allowed to wipe out the terrorists. You've got entry points. I've been to some of the entry points. There's an entry point from Egypt. There's several of them that enter into Israel. Why do you need to build a dock? So that the Hamas terrorists can import contraband weapons, bombs, and bullets from Turkey and other places like that? That's the only reason to put a port on the Mediterranean, or unless I'm missing something, Ari.
No, you're 100% right. Let's remember, let's go way, way back to October 9th, October 10th, when this was all starting after the October 7th attacks. And when they said we need to get aid to the Palestinians, immediately the first question was, well, wait a minute, Gaza is controlled by Hamas. So if they're the government of Gaza, you're literally giving the aid to Hamas.
Yep.
And they said, no, 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 we have ways to stop that from happening. Well, they lied, or they were wrong, one way or the other. And we know the aid is going to the terrorists. So while Israel is fighting a war, while there are American hostages, while Americans were killed on October 7th, we're literally supplying the people who did it. And it makes no sense at all.
And not only that, but you're giving the Hamas terrorists, even though there may be 30% of the people in Gaza who don't support Hamas, who don't like living under the occupation of a terrorist organization, the other 70% do. So if you say, well, we're trying to get the aid to these people, the minute you put that aid, as you pointed out, into the hands of a terrorist organization that can do the same thing with aid there that they were doing in Mogadishu, you know, when we lost service members there, you say, we're sending aid. And you go, yeah, and you know who controls it? The terrorists, the warlords. And so what do they do with that aid? They feed their own people. You know, that means that keeps the terrorists going. And they're able to tell the people who don't like Hamas so much, you want to get some food? You want to get the things you need? You're going to have to go along with us. I mean, it isn't in America, but in many parts of the world, food is an incredible weapon that can be used by people with evil intent. They can say, you either go along with us or you don't eat. And that's a powerful motivator, don't you think?
And that's exactly what they're doing to the hostages. The hostages that came back from the terror tunnels in Gaza. We're talking about how maybe they got a bowl of rice, maybe a little bit more. But we've sent in all of this aid and expected nothing in return. Tell me, Lars, you know history a little bit better than I do. But during World War II, was anybody concerned about the Nazis? Was anybody concerned about the Germans, the innocent Germans? No, we went in and we had to denazify Germany. And unfortunately, I don't think a lot of people have the stomach to do what it takes. And I don't think people in the U.S. realize that Jews are united like never before, that Israelis are united like never before, and they ain't gonna stop. One of the reasons that Israel canceled this delegation out to the U.S. is what? They're going to be lectured on war by Anthony Blinken, Joe Biden, and Lloyd? I mean, come on.
No, it doesn't make any sense. And when they say, well, you can't attack a civilian population, maybe we could conjure up the ghosts of people in Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and Dresden and say, you know, we don't bomb civilian populations when we're in a war where people are dying. We don't bomb those people. Well, yeah, as a matter of fact, we do, and we have. And I know some Americans feel guilty about Nagasaki and Hiroshima. I don't. Because I say, well, it saved millions of lives on both sides, and we might have to do it again. And Dresden was the same kind of situation. You're bombing an entire city. Why? It's full of civilians. You're only going to get a few combatants. Yeah, but we're going to stop what's going on. And I think that's what Israel plans to do. And meanwhile, Joe Biden is sitting on the fence. And Ari, as I pointed out earlier, Joe Biden and Donald Trump are both going to be in New York City tomorrow. And Joe Biden is there for a big dollar fundraiser, and Donald Trump is there to go to the wake of a slaughtered New York City police officer. Back in a moment. That's Ari Hoffman from the Ari Hoffman Show on our Seattle affiliate, KDI. I'll be back in a moment. You got the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
before you are, weeding out the right from the wrong. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. If you thought it was crazy already that Joe Biden is going to force Americans to go and buy electric cars because he's going to give them no choice, he's mandating that a giant percentage of automobiles sold in America in just the next few years must be electrics, which means the cost of all the gasoline powers cars that are still being up for sale is going to go up dramatically, because I don't think people want the electric cars. Americans are not buying into the lie. But I want to get into what California is doing now with trains, and it's even more insane, and it threatens to make an already tenuous supply chain problem that America has right now get a whole lot worse. But let me get to that in just a moment. First, I want to start with Tia. Hey, Tia, thanks a lot for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, hold on. Let me put you on the actual phone so you can hear me better.
That would be good, because we hate speakerphones. Yeah. The speakerphones drive everybody nuts. So,
excellent. I'm the president of the Oregon Rental Housing Association, and I'm an eviction specialist. And I kind of wanted to switch the topic back to,
sure.
The squatter thing. A long-time sporadic listener, first-time caller. I just want to reassure your Oregon listeners that there is a relatively quick and easy process for removing actual squatters from a property. Oregon allows for landlords to serve a 24-hour notice for an unlawful occupant and then take that person to court. You'll get to court in 8 to 10 days, maybe up to 2 weeks. But, the process is just a few weeks long. I don't know the landlord-tenant laws and other states and why it could be so challenging, but despite all Oregon's many failings, that's actually one thing they do that is relatively speedy.
Well, that sounds good. Can I ask you a couple of questions? Because to the other states, I don't know all 50, 58 if you're an Obama voter, but 50 for the rest of us, but in New York, the stat that's come out this week is that the average time to remove a squatter is 20 months. Now, that's because of clogged up courts and everything else. And I don't see any reason to have to take that long. I mean, if you can establish, and this is for somebody who's an honest God squatter. So somebody who never was a tenant, they got into the property somehow, they started camping out there. And then when you showed up, they said, I'm not going to leave. And the police said, we're not going to help you. And you have to go to court. You're saying that you can give a 24-hour notice and then a file for court and get into court how fast?
The court first appearance would be at a minimum, the least amount would be 8 days, and it could go get set out, 10 to even 14 days, depending on the court schedule. And yeah, the courts are a lot busier than they were since the passage of House Bill 2001. But it's still, the horror stories I'm hearing from New York, I have no reason to doubt them, but that's not the case here in Oregon. So I just,
well, tell me this. So you got to finish the rest of the process though. So you've started the process, you get into court in at most 2 weeks. Then what happens?
Mm-hmm. Well, if the unauthorized occupant shows up, you can negotiate them out, or they do have the right to ask for a trial. That trial would be scheduled fairly quickly, no later than 14 days out, but usually it's just a couple of days, at least in Lane County. Different counties operate on different timelines based on their staffing and how many cases they've got on a specific.
So they can get a trial. So you show up in court in at most 14 days, and then you can get a court date within another 2 weeks?
Yes.
And then how long for that?
If the squatter shows up and challenges it. If the squatter doesn't show up at all, you get to default them. You file and serve, once the judgment's signed, you file and serve a notice of restitution that gives them an additional minimum of 4 days to vacate the premises before you could hire the sheriff to do a forcible removal. So all in all, it's relatively speedy as these things go.
It sounds like a month.
Months, and certainly. Yeah.
It sounds like a month or so.
Right.
But that means, and then I'm guessing that if they're a determined squatter, they, move on to another property?
Yeah, likely. And that's why I advise my members, when you have a vacant property, you better be guarding that property. You better go to the police, sign a trespass letter of consent, or at least let them know the property's vacant. Nobody should be living there. Put up no trespassing signs. Put up cameras. Make sure that property's really secured. Not only do we have to contend with squatters and vacant properties, but people who go in and steal the appliances and the copper out of the walls and all that fun stuff as well. So it's really important that if a landlord has a vacant property, that they're guarding that property.
Let me ask you this. Does it help at all if you keep all the utilities turned off to the property?
It can. It certainly makes it less desirable. But, you know, there was a story I read. Gosh, was it out of Florida? I'm not sure where it was. But a guy moved in. He created a fake lease because the utility company would not turn on the power in his name unless he had this lease, right? But they don't verify that the person's the owner or that the person even, you know, that the owner even agreed to enter into this lease. And then he got the utilities on in his name, lived there for 10 months, got the landlord to pay him 10 grand to leave. And, you know, and it was a horrible experience. But I struggle to understand, like, Oregon's super liberal. I mean, it's not as bad as California and New York, but not by much in Washington. Those states are a little worse, but for Oregon,
well, because I was just talking to Jonathan Cho from Discovery Center. He's a journalist we talk to all the time. They've been fighting this one squatter in Seattle. The landlord has been taking actions trying to get rid of this guy, and the guy just refuses to leave. What the heck's his name? His name is Jaskaran Singh is the owner, and this guy Kim is Sang Kim is the tenant, and it's been months and they can't get rid of this guy. So Oregon actually has it dialed in right.
Yeah, I mean, you know, relatively speaking, obviously, sure, it would be nice to have like Florida, you know, where they just drag
immediate
out
removal,
or, you know, could, yeah, but then, you know, I take calls from folks who think, you know, they'll tell me, Tia, I have a squatter on my property. And as it turns out, it's somebody that they let live there, right? So I understand the right for people to have the right of due process. Or maybe it's somebody that the prior tenant invited in and just left behind for the landlord to find. The police don't know who's entitled to be at a property. And so I get the need for due process. But, yeah, that sounds crazy.
Yeah, but Tia, on, I mean, it's been a long time since I owned a little duplex. And I owned it for about 11 years. And so I had some experience, but it was very limited. So on a standard form, if the landlord rents to Joe and Susie, and then Joe and Susie let Sam move into the property, Sam ain't on the lease. So that seems like it'd be pretty easy to establish. Is your name on the lease? No, but my friend said I could live here. Well, you can't leave.
Well, in that case, the violation is with the tenants. So in that case, you serve a notice of termination with cause to the lawful tenants who are allowing the unauthorized occupant.
No, even if they've left?
Sort of be in the unit.
Once they leave,
if you've never expected, if you've never collected or agreed to accept money from that person who's been left behind, you know, they may have paid money to the people who are leaving, whatever, they have no rights.
They don't have any tenant rights even if they've been there, say, for 30 days?
Correct. Correct. That's correct.
Hey, Tia, we want to get your contact. I want to get your contact information. This is great information because in much of America, California for sure has had a mess. Washington State appears to have a mess. Florida did. They've now passed a new law. New York, that sounds like a total nightmare because they've got people who literally own homes. They may have inherited them from family members, and all of a sudden they've got a squatter. And they're saying, yeah, you can go to court, but it's going to take you 20 months to get rid of them. Tia, hold on for just a minute. Let Joel get your contact information. By the way, I do want to mention one thing. I've got three great producers, Joel Maha and Donovan Sargent and Mackenzie Prunty. And Mackenzie's birthday is today, so we're wishing Mackenzie a very happy birthday on the Lars Larson Show. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. On demand, wherever and whenever you want it. Get the podcasts all day, every day at LarsLarson.com.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I got to tell you something. I constantly, for the last 4 or 5 decades, have heard schools and school districts claim that they really care about the concerns of parents. And they'll have parent-teacher nights, and they'll talk to citizens and taxpayers. And usually what they want is money, and they actually aren't that interested in what you have to say. But they want to put on a good show. And lately, it has become a little bit different from that. Lately, schools have said, we will teach your kids, and you have almost nothing to say about it, including famously when the guy Terry McAuliffe, who was I guess on paper, as a Democrat, the odds-on guy to end up winning as governor of Virginia. He didn't. And one of the big reasons he didn't was one day on the debate stage, he declared, parents have no business telling us what we teach your kids. And I think that kind of summed up. He said the quiet part out loud for a change. So I wanted to get Tony Kinnett on, who's an investigative columnist for the Daily Signal, to talk about some of the examples of what's going on with schools, with parents, with the kind of sexual indoctrination that I believe is being done to kids in public schools. And the school districts are essentially taking an antagonistic attitude toward parents who object to that. Tony, welcome back to the program. And tell me, do you disagree with anything I just said?
No, and not only because I lived it as an administrator in the system, but because time and time again, we've seen kind of a cycle. We've seen individuals say, oh, this isn't happening. It's never happened. You guys are just making stuff up, to, well, it may be happening, but it's rare, to, yeah, it's happening and it's good that it's happening. And then the cycle starts over again with something worse. And that's, quite honestly, I could come up with example after example of just atrocious situations of this happening in school districts.
I don't think anybody likes being lied to, but the other thing lying to me tells me, if somebody is proud and proud of what they're doing and sure that what they're doing is the right thing to do. I mean, if somebody said to me, Lars, you own guns. I say, yeah, I do, quite a few, and I lock them up safely and I use them lawfully. I don't ever deny it, saying, well, no, I really don't own guns. Perish the thought. You don't deny doing things if you think they are right. The only time you lie and say, oh, no, we're not doing that at all. And I've seen the same cycle, Tony. I mean, for months I had people saying, Lars, you keep talking about this transgender stuff. And we've talked to our local school and they say it's not happening. And then later they say, oh, now the school. And they went through just exactly the cycle you described. If these people in education actually believe that what they're doing is right for the kids, then why not say it out loud?
Well, because honestly, I think that they're giving kind of the closed off trial period where they go for a couple years and it's happening, but they don't really talk about it. So that in a couple years when they're open about it and you complain, they say, oh, we've been doing this for years and you haven't had a problem with it up until now. And that's what happened in an Arizona school district just the other day.
That's Flagstaff, right?
Yeah, yeah. Flagstaff Unified, not very unified at the moment, I must admit. And they had a poster in the elementary that advertised a transgender name change clinic where you could go and change your name legally without any parental knowledge or approval or permission. And that was in an elementary school. That's where they put that flyer. It was for all ages, is what the poster said.
You know, I wouldn't have a problem if it, on that note, on with a school district that said, we will never tell your kids something that we won't also tell you. And we will never encourage your kids to keep a secret from parents. And that should apply to everything, not just trans, but everything. Aren't these school administrators admitting by saying, we're going to have this secret deal and it's only going to be us, strangers and government employees, and your child, and they will keep the secret from parents? Doesn't anybody inside the system, except maybe you, recognize that anything you do where we keep secrets from parents of children is evil to begin with?
Yeah, and they end up losing their job for it. I exposed a situation in an Indiana school where a counselor did not like being told that she had to keep, like, a student had supposedly transitioned at school. And so then when the counselor and the teachers that worked with that counselor communicated with the parents, they were to use a different name and different pronouns to hide from the parent that something was going on with their kid. And she spoke up for it, and she was fired for it. And that also is happening all around the country. So those that speak up, the nail that sticks up is the one that gets hammered down.
Yep. Well, and what happened then when that staffer who did the right thing and would think, if I told this to a jury, they'd say you did the right thing, the school district did the wrong thing by firing you. Aren't all these school districts and hence the taxpayers going to eat a tremendous amount of damage from this kind of stuff?
They absolutely are. It's a lose-lose situation for the taxpayer. And that's one of the reasons that school choice has become such a popular issue in the country. It was only a couple years ago that I was actually told by a prominent conservative columnist who I admire that education would never even make the top 10. And now it's consistently polling in the top 5. And it's for this reason alone. You cannot win as a taxpayer when either you're funding lawsuits or you're funding the indoctrination and the separation of children.
I mean, Tony, tell me, feel free to tell me if you think I'm completely wrong, but I've always been a little bit unhappy about school districts and other elements of government, that, and they have all these organizations, and they always get together for meetings. You know, the Council of League of Cities, League of Counties, you know, states, League of States, School District Administrators Associations, all these things. Right. And in theory, what these things are for is so administrators and teachers and all the other people involved can get together once a year and have a little party somewhere and stay in a nice hotel and eat your dinners and can slap each other on the back. But it, the good part of it, if any of this happens, is when they say, hey, we tried this stuff in our district and it turned out to be a total train wreck. I'd stay away from it if I were you, or don't do it the way we did it. And others who said, we handled it this way. Is any of that still happening in education?
No, not at all. I'm the former science coordinator, which is a fancy academic way of saying science director for Indianapolis Public Schools. And when they would have large administrator conferences, everyone goes there. And the idea of actually talking about what we did and didn't do that worked and didn't work, oh, those are like... Well, I'm not even talking gone. Those are long gone, like 1985 gone. In fact, it's more like, you've read 1984, right?
I have several times.
Right. So when Orwell is outlining the party, you actually just say, well, the only reason we didn't meet the goal is because we didn't go far enough. That's the only, like self-reflection. It's, well, we weren't inclusive
enough. You mean like socialism where they say, oh yeah, no socialist system has ever survived, but they didn't do it enough, or they didn't do it, yeah. You know, in, they didn't do it the right way. We're now going to do socialism the right way. That's what they said.
Very no true Scots. And really, it's just give us another four-year plan. And we saw this again, to point out my home district, with Indianapolis Public Schools. We're on like our third or fourth four-year racial equity plan. Guess what? Students who are black and Hispanic, their scores haven't improved. But boy, if you just give them another $8 million in another 4 years, I'm sure that'll turn it around.
Okay, so is the whole system going to come to some kind of watershed moment where they either go one direction or the other? Because as much as I want, and I encourage parents to homeschool, to private school, to get your kids the heck out of the public schools, there's still a big institution that's being fed tens of billions of dollars, if not trillions, over the last decade that should get either fixed or wiped out flat.
I go back and forth on that one. My wife and I actually have an article over at the Daily Caller we wrote a couple years ago called Why Two Award-Winning Teachers Will Do Nothing Else But Homeschool Their Kids. And we dug into this a little bit. I think that the future is probably micro-schooling, so parents forming homeschool pods and hiring a teacher to teach their kids. But honestly, as for a watershed moment, I think it still remains to be seen, because that'll depend on what beast is fed when. And honestly, I got to tell you, Americans are really just tired of the whole thing. And
I think you're right. That's Tony Kinnock, who is investigative columnist for the Daily Signal. He's worked within the belly of the beast. Tony, I appreciate the time. We'll be back in a moment. 866, hey Lars, you're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Snowflakes, yes, you are probably going to be offended. This is the Lars Larson
Show. Welcome back to Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. It's not a pleasure to have to tell you this. U.S. Senator Joe Lieberman has died at the age of 82. I've had the pleasure of meeting the man. I didn't agree with him on much politically, but I didn't have a lot of bad things to say about him. He was a Democrat. He became an independent. He was 82 years of age, and his wife, Hadassah, and members of the family were with him when he passed away. And so he served as a U.S. senator, and we had done some remotes in which we talked to Senator Lieberman. And as I said, he was one of those guys who was quite liberal, but he was willing to talk about things. And as I tell people all the time, because I get these wonderful emails from people saying, well, you should get Jay Inslee on and ask him this or ask him that, or get Tina Kotek on and ask why her alcoholic, mentally ill wife should be given a state job. She doesn't have a job yet, but she wants to. Tina Kotek wants her wife to be a have the official position of the office of the first spouse, I guess is what it comes down to. So already she's got an office in the governor's office. She's got two staff members. She has security and access to private meetings. And none of this was approved by the legislature. And she's already had an ethics violation filed against her, that is Tina Kotek, for taking these actions without any kind of sign off by the people's representatives. And then comes out today, or effectively last night, and says, well, my wife is mentally ill, and she also has an unspecified addiction. Apparently it's alcohol, but she's in recovery. But she also says she won't say how long she's been in recovery. And at least my personal experience, having grown up with an alcoholic dad, every time I've interviewed somebody who is a former addict or a former alcoholic, alcoholics will always tell you that once you're an alcoholic, you will always be susceptible to alcoholism. And even if you've been dry a long time. But one of the things I've always noticed is that if you talk to somebody who's beat alcohol and they've been clean and sober, one of the first things they'll usually tell you is, I've been clean and sober 5 years, 4 months, and 3 days. And they know it that precisely, because it is a tremendous victory. So what happened when reporters asked Governor Kotek, who will not come on this program, but she's invited all the time, how long has she been in recovery, if you say she's in recovery? If they won't say, chances are the time is very, very short. But I did want to mention to you that we just got word minutes ago that U.S. Senator Joe Lieberman has passed away at the age of 82, surrounded by his family. He was a Democrat U.S. senator, became an independent. He was a vice presidential nominee as well. And I would mention that. And they called him a moderate voice in the Senate. I don't know if there is such a thing as a moderate Democrat anymore. They all seem to be very, very extreme. He was Al Gore's running mate 24 years ago, and in a case in which George Bush beat Al Gore, and Al Gore forced the process all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, trying to make Florida count the votes differently. Except that back then, I guess being an election denier, as Al Gore was not a bad thing. But now the Democrats have decided that it's only okay to deny elections if you happen to be a member of the Democrat Party. If you're Donald Trump, you're not allowed to deny elections at all. So double standards, or they'd have none at all. This segment of the show is brought to you by the home power generating folks at ProTech Power. Make sure your loved ones are safe when the power goes out. 541-ONA-GEN. Just call 541-ONA-GEN. Our poll on X today. If Northwest highways get too crowded, should tolls be used to push the poor off the road? It's exactly the solution that's being used in the Puget Sound region right now, because they tell people, well, you can get on the freeway and you can be parked in a giant parking lot on the freeway. You aren't going to move very fast at all. If you want to get in the fast lane, you have to pay extra to use the road that your taxes have already paid for. Taxes, road fees, gas taxes, and all the rest of that. So they're using tolls to try to do what they call congestion pricing. And in Oregon, while Governor Kotek has put a temporary hold on the idea of tolling because she got gigantic pushback, in some counties, the opposition to tolling is as much as 80%. Statewide, it's about 70% are opposed to it. And yet, folks in the state bureaucracy, they seem not to give a damn what the public has to say. They say, oh, yeah, we're still looking at congestion pricing. In fact, the NBC affiliate, KGW, and my friend Pat Doris at The Big Story, he quotes this guy named Finn from ODOT. And he says, one of the biggest economic drivers in Washington County is the semiconductor industry and Nike and Genentech and the rest. A lot of huge employers that are great employers, meaning they pay big paychecks. But they say they think the solution to congestion is congestion pricing, meaning if you've got the money, if you have a nice job, if you get a big paycheck, you'll be able to drive to work. If you don't, you say you work a minimum wage job or just above minimum wage, well, then you're going to be forced to make changes. You'll have to work somewhere else. You'll have to live somewhere else. You'll have to pay through the nose to be able to drive down the roads that you actually already paid for. That makes no sense to me at all. Today's Poll on X is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Yesterday's poll, let me give you the results. Donald Trump has now put his name on the God Bless the USA Bible. Is that sacrilegious, as some on the left say? 80% of you, along with me, said no, it's not sacrilegious. It's wonderful. The most published book in the world, the best book in the world. A book full of truth, and now it has Donald Trump's name on it? I think that's fantastic. Only 20% of you said, yes, it is sacrilegious. You've got the Lars.